Coming up today, the BBC is giving up on 3D after 2 years of trying to make the service work. A new innovation in cycle helmets uses nothing more than paper to protect your head. And the UK has finally expanded its efforts in the hunt for extraterrestrial intelligence. Plus, we'll hear your feedback and answer some of your questions. All that and more coming up now. This is the Why Duck at UK podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to DNA sequencing and ungoogleable musicians. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Why Duck at UK.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Liat Clark.
And we have a full team back.
Yay!
Hurrah! Yay. I missed you guys last week.
Aww.
It was great to get Katie on the show.
Yes,
I think
Katie
was
great.
Fab. We'll definitely be hearing more from her, I think, over the coming months and years and decades. So later on in the show today, we're going to hear about a new trend where young bands are deliberately giving themselves ungoogleable names. Why, Liat? Wonders.
You know.
No, don't answer it. That's coming up later.
I think I have an answer.
Yeah, well, we've got lots of answers. That's a tease. But first, the BBC will hit pause on its 3D programming project when it reaches the end of its 2-year trial later this year. Following a Doctor Who special, a 3-year hiatus from developing 3D content will ensue due to a lack of public interest in the medium. This is according to Kim Shillingslaw, the BBC's head of 3D, or at least for the time being. Sounds like she's sort of done herself out of a job.
Yeah.
At least for 3 years. So quick interjection here. 3D, the death of disappointment or glee?
I wouldn't say I'm gleeful, but I'm not very surprised and I'm not very bothered.
Liv?
It just has no bearing on my... I don't have a 3D TV, yeah. So that, you know, whether or not the 3D signal's being... I say beamed, that sounds a bit...
Yeah. The three people
being
in my
delivered,
borough watching it.
Well, you haven't got a 3D TV. I haven't got a 3D TV. Leah, I don't think you've
got
a 3D
TV.
But around 1.5 million British households do have a 3D equipped TV, but only around half of those tuned in to watch the Olympic opening ceremony last year. And, you know, you would
that's
argue
like the
that...
the biggest thing that you would watch.
Exactly. Yeah. But only half the people who owned a TV tuned in 3D. So it's really disappointing. And also, the BBC isn't the only broadcaster that's deciding to end its 3D content because it's not taking off. The sports network ESPN has also announced that it will discontinue its 3D programming by the end of this year. Really disappointing. There was a quote that came out actually from in the Radio Times, which is who the head of 3D, Kim, was speaking to, and she said that, quote, watching 3D is quite a hassly experience in the home. You've got to find glasses before switching on the TV. I think when people watch TV, they concentrate in a different way. When people go to the cinema, they go and are used to doing one thing. I think that that's one of the reasons that the take-up of 3D TV has been so disappointing. It's just a hassle of a process.
It's an experience.
But that's not to say that it's not going to come back. It just seems like it's not been the right time yet.
Won't come back. I don't honestly think it'll come back while I have to put something ridiculous on my face.
And it costs a lot of money.
That too. But, you know, the price of 3D TV has come down. The problem is the glasses cost everything. If you have a child, you've got to think, well, I have to buy it some glasses, put it on its face.
But it's also more expensive to record in 3D because you need to have, you need to be recording two feeds at the same time.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I mean, we learnt a lot of that from the other week when we spoke to one of the producers from David Attenborough's new programme. Mm. They had red epic cameras. They were like 5K per camera. Slammed together on one tiny macro lens, so they were shooting in almost 10K in order to get 3D footage.
Whoa.
So going out in 1080p. Anyway, we're getting a bit too deep, but I think the next thing we'll see to replace this is going to be 4K. We're already seeing 4K TVs being sold. We've got the consoles, Xbox One and PS4, both of which it's believed are going to support 4K movies, if not games. So
do you think there's more hope for them?
I think there's a whole lot more hope for 4K than 3D. Mm. As ever, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. That's where we place our eyes on your words and interpret them into content for the podcast in future. Let's move on to the second story. A bit more serious this. The first child born with DNA sequencing, or with a DNA sequencing IVF technique, has happened.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I mean, okay, how often do you guys think IVF works?
About one in every four cases?
Well... 32.2% in under 35s, and that figure like plummets after that. So a team headed up by an Oxford University professor is now using genome sequencing to develop a faster and cheaper method of embryo screening. It's called next generation sequencing and basically uses computer software to scan and count all the DNA fragments in the embryo to make sure there's the correct number of chromosomes. So what happens more often than not, as we've seen with IVS, is that abnormalities in the chromosome or there's not the correct number of chromosomes in the embryo means it fails to implant, and the embryo, the fetus does not reach full term. So this new technique takes just 16 hours, which is kind of ridiculous when you look to older techniques. It's basically, number one is look and see. You literally just look at the embryo under a microscope after a short time of development and see if there's any kind of obvious visual defects. But the other techniques that we've been using are only related to inherited genetic disorders. And what they actually do is they'll extract one cell from the embryo, which might not sound like a lot, but we're talking about an embryo that has 8 cells. So they take one cell on day 2 and they will test for a specific disorder if the parent has that disorder and they're worried about it. And obviously there's kind of related problems with extracting the cell and then waiting for the results for a few days. You have to freeze the embryo and unfreeze the embryo. So their results have been pretty incredible, but it's kind of very early stages. The cost of doing the genetic testing right now for what I was talking about, taking one cell, is thousands of pounds. And the guys behind this say they're going to basically completely revolutionize it, slash the price of it. It will be done, you know, in less than 24 hours for a fraction of the cost, and is far more accurate because it's actually looking at all the chromosomes.
And so the news here is that a child has been born using this technique.
Yeah, the first child has been born. So actually only 2 women have been in the trial. They looked at something like 45 embryos that they knew had defects, and the system worked every time. And then they managed to implant 2 healthy embryos in 2 women. And one of them's expecting the baby and one of them gave birth in June. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's they've obviously acknowledged it's a tiny, tiny trial, and they're going to do a much bigger one later this year because the results have been so great.
So your report is available. I think if you search child born IVF, you'll find your feature. It's an incredibly detailed write-up, I have to say.
You're already listening to the Wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in?
It's time to go from babies to helmets. Sometimes,
what a transition.
Sometimes they are combined, sometimes they are separated, although hopefully not as the result of an accident. Paper helmets apparently could make cycle share schemes safer, according to Wired.co.uk this week.
Yeah, this is a team of RCA students who came up with a great idea after becoming quite concerned about the lack of cycle helmet provision with things like Boris bikes in London.
Barclay bikes.
I know, Barclays is the official sponsor, but let's face it, we all call them Boris bikes.
I know, but I had a coffee with the PR that does that the other day, and every time I said Boris bike, she went, Barclay.
It's like Pavlovian kind of response eventually. Yeah. So Thomas Gotelier, Bobby Peterson and Edward Thomas, they're all ex-RCA. And what they did was they've developed a helmet using materials that are readily available in the city, namely loads of free copies of newspapers such as the Evening Standard and the Metro. And so they've come up with this super cheap helmet. And it looks a little bit like the material used in egg boxes. They can make these helmets for a cost of as little as £1. And so they could be sold alongside these cycle hire scheme docking areas.
Now, are helmets made out of paper actually safe? I mean, I asked this you as a cyclist.
Yeah.
Because you're a fan of the pedals.
I am. I love them.
Yeah. And I believe that you wear a helmet.
I wear a helmet, and I wouldn't get on a Boris bike without my helmet. But these have been tested. I say paper, it sounds like it's a little flimsy thing that you folded out of a newspaper. It's actually not. It's made by grinding the newspaper with water and adding some colouring and waterproofing. And this is then placed into a mould and dried out. It's kind of paper papier-mâché. And the resulting material is really strong and cheap. And it's actually passed some European cycle helmet safety standards.
Oh, wow.
So it's actually that. It is not as safe as some of the more kind of expensive helmets, but it does meet safety standards.
Don't you think we really shouldn't need a kind of cheap, coolly designed helmet to encourage people to wear bike helmets? It's like a standard thing you should be doing if you're cycling to work in London.
Yeah, but if you decide suddenly you're going to cycle instead of getting the tube, you don't necessarily have a helmet if you cycle maybe once every other week. So there should be an opportunity to buy one without having to fork out 30 or 40 quid in your nearest Evans Cycles or similar cycle establishment.
Other bicycle outlets are available. But yeah. I do think though that it could be quite interesting if you could make these at home.
Yeah.
I do like the idea of, you know, you take the Metro or Evening Standard home after a day, and then that becomes the helmet for the next morning, and then you pick up another paper.
I think the market they're going for is spontaneous cyclists, as opposed to people who are going to spend
a craft session.
Have a craft afternoon and make their own helmet.
A craft afternoon?
Yeah.
Live.
I think she's done that before.
My housemate is a very keen crafter, so she's been to many a craftenoon. Hi, Laura, if you're listening. But anyway, the website, you can look on the website and you can see what the helmets look like. At the moment, it's pretty evident that they haven't quite nailed the design. It looks somewhere between an egg box and a World War I helmet. So the plan is, they say, to make it thicker and more stylish.
Two excellent improvements.
I want a craftenoon.
We can have one.
Can we have a wired craft-a-noon?
Look at what we're surrounded by.
But let's do it with 3D printers.
Yeah, an Arduino.
An Arduino. This is good.
Raspberry Pi.
Let's make an event out of this. This is a great idea.
We have got an event out of this. Next generation.
Yeah. Okay, well, you know what I mean. One just for us. For grown-ups. Okay, fantastic. Well, we've got one more story we want to get to before our break. And this is the fact that there is a new school curriculum that is emphasizing coding, climate change, 3D design, taking the emphasis away from here's how you bold text.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. My 10-year-old self is super jealous of this. And there's going to be a lot of craft-a-noons in school with 3D printers, it looks like. But it's that they are literally going to be doing what we wish we could be doing every afternoon. So the new national curriculum will have 5-year-olds building computer programs. 5-year-olds.
This makes me want to have kids.
So
I can have a child come home from school and say, Daddy, I built an app. Putting an app on an iPhone is kind of the next generation of putting a crap painting on a fridge. Because let's be honest, and there are actually apps out there that let you document your child's paintings and you can catalogue them by child and the date they did them and the themes and stuff like that. So you don't have to keep the actual paper around.
So sad.
But I think the next best thing would be, you know, let's play the app that you made today.
Yeah. I think you're being a bit unfair on the painting. I don't think this is about replacing the painting.
We're not replacing
aspect of it. It's about replacing having to write a secretarial letter or using yours faithfully or
creating
yours sincerely.
Creating a PowerPoint presentation of what I did at school today.
But there's going to be a de-emphasis on teaching kids how to use stuff like Word as part of this, right?
Absolutely.
Which makes sense.
I can't believe this is only just happening. I assumed that this was revolutionized years ago because I can't believe, as Liv was saying, that my IT class was writing a letter.
Yeah.
I also think that there's going to be a focus on online safety, things like how, you know, what you put online, how that affects you maybe in future, how search history works.
They're doing this from like day one.
Such a good idea.
You know, from 5 years old, they're going to be telling them every year, yes, this is amazing, teaching them coding, algorithms, everything. But they're going to be teaching them all the way along, you know, the actual gravity of what they're doing and what they're sharing and, you know, be mindful of sharing any kind of personal data. So at the end of key stage 3, when they're around 14, they'll be able to use at least 2 programming languages, understand binary code. They'll be using computer-aided design, basically 3D printing. I don't think they said in the document when they released this draft that they would be using 3D printing, but according to a Whitehall source that spoke to The Guardian, like every classroom is going to have a 3D printer, which is ace.
I think Ryman is going to start selling 3D printers. Yeah. I think once it starts being in somewhere like that, it's just going to be the next thing. It's like pencils, check pencil case, check rubbers, check pencil erasers. I mean,
art class is going to be so much fun.
A 3D printer, 3D printing components. It's great.
It's amazing.
Great. I'll go back to school.
Yeah, I can't even believe it. This is, you know, a 7-year-old is going to have more experience with a 3D printer than me.
When is this going to start happening? Do we know?
Well, they are they're kind of at the draft stage, so they're doing a consultation process this year, and the results of that will come out this autumn, and then they'll see. I mean, you know, they already had a lot of flack for the original curriculum from Labour, and that's why they've kind of made some of these tweaks, including climate change is actually in geography again, because that was going to get scrapped. That's another thing that's been brought back.
Great.
So I think in a more feasibly in a couple years' time, you'll have to talk to Cameron.
Well, we know we have quite a few people who listen in schools, teachers, head teachers, pupils, obviously. Let us know what you think to this. So opinion on this subject, obviously massively valuable. podcast@wired.co.uk. We will read it out next week. And we're going to transition into a quick break. But when we come back, what do you think the typical gamer looks like? We ask you this every week. Do you want a free audiobook? Of course you do. Audible.co.uk is offering you, the listener, any audiobook to download from a catalogue of 80,000 just for being a Wired.co.uk podcast listener. Now, 1 month free trial of Audible.co.uk costs no pounds, no pences, and whatever you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you choose to cancel your account. And an audiobook, of course, is basically just a podcast, but several hours longer. So if you head to audible.co.uk/wired, sign up in a few seconds, download any book. You'll then be supporting our show here every single week, which we like and we appreciate, and you get a free book as a thank you. There's very little not to like. That's audible.co.uk/wired. Welcome back. That was a break. This is the second part of the show. This is where we break into our segment cake and chew a slice and see what the jam tastes
like. You like your cake?
The first segment we're talking about this week, though, is Gaming the System. This is the section we talk about video games, and a study has come out that tries to describe the average gamer. Now, I'm going to ask you two this first. Do you think, in fact, no, describe what you think the average video gamer is. Maybe age, maybe gender, maybe personality, maybe other.
I think the thing
traits.
is there's such a stereotype that exists out there in the world, but that is not a stereotype that we know, because we have a slightly different view on the world at Wired.
A greater view, you might
a
say.
A greater view. I mean, the stereotype is that it's a teenage boy in his bedroom and that no one else plays video games.
Or university age as well.
Well, apparently that is not the case. I mean, we knew that anyway, but now a study has come out that says that. It would be a bit of a blow to stereotype fans everywhere, but this study of 2,000 gamers has shown that rather than those stereotypes we've talked about, the average gamer is 35 years old, so it's older than all of us, with a job, so the same as us.
It can afford to
buy a family. Exactly, so we've got some money. A family and a habit of taking 4 weeks to finish a game on average.
Sounds slow.
Quite interesting. I do wonder, though, you know, again, there's a little bit of survey bias here, and I'm very curious to know sort of how these participants were selected, because 35 does seem older than I would imagine as an average age.
I would have thought mid to late 20s.
Yeah, I would say. But the poll was commissioned by Pixwoo, which is a gaming social network that started in 2012. And I do think this is a bit of a PR study, but it made for a good conversation. So it just means you've got to take the results with a grain of salt.
Actually makes a lot of sense if you think, okay, mid-30s, you've already got enough money to be spending on it all the time. You've got kids, so you've got a really good excuse to buy the console.
And, you don't
and
have
then
time
when
to
they go
out.
To bed, you just play it all the time and shut out all those
the world.
Whinges from
That's what
the
I
kids.
Do.
Yeah, I think it's...
It was Philippa that wrote up this story, and she actually asked me, it's like, when was the last time you stayed up all night playing video games and didn't go to bed? And I was like, it's not that long ago.
Every night.
Fallout. I think it was Elder Scrolls, a Skyrim DLC. Though a lot of the time it happens because we get games early before they're released, but sometimes if it's like the final code, it's only a few days ahead of time. And for some games that take 20, 30 hours to finish, it does kind of mean staying up all night playing games. But it's technically work, so I'm not complaining, getting paid to play games all night. But anyway, as with any study dealing with averages, some of these results are a little bit over-specific. The average gamer apparently stays up until 10:58 p.m. precisely playing video games, unless it's a special occasion, in which case they might manage 1:12 a.m. Very special occasion.
Very special.
A Friday night.
Birthdays and...
Yeah, some other facts pull out of here. Gaming is given as a source of 2 arguments per week with a partner.
That's amazing.
And 15% of those polled have broken up over an issue related to gaming. Liv, you don't seem impressed with this study.
No, I think it's interesting. I do wonder whether Pixwoo, the gaming social network that conducted the study, is trying to increase its advertising revenue by, claiming to have that gaming's generally a kind
so
of older,
cynical.
Richer sort of user than.
Well, that's what I said before. Like, it's a bit of a PR, bit of a PR thing, but it does make for an interesting conversation. Like, these days, what is the average gamer like in the typical stereotype? Because I do think it has moved on.
Yeah, and it is.
And we haven't even touched upon gender.
Anyway.
I don't know what the study revealed about gender balance, but again, there have been studies before that have shown that there's a much higher proportion of women gamers than the stereotype suggests. I think kind of 40% sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, particularly with mobile games, casual games, you know, the female demographic. You know, games like The Sims has a massive, just enormous female following for those sorts of games that really balances out what is sometimes with a lot of games like that, well, strategy games can be quite a male bias, typically, anyway. Next, what's up with space? Tell you what's up with space. The UK has expanded its search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yeah, the UK is getting in there and taking away some of the limelight from the US, which actually dominates this sector. The UK is upping its search for alien life forms by bringing together astronomers from 11 different institutions across the company. And they're actually going to be funded by SETI, which is the institute in the US. Search for Extraterrestrial Institute.
No, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Whatever. Intelligence. An amazing name for an organization.
It's an amazing organization.
They actually lost government funding in the US in 1995, and they've been privately funded ever since then, and the UK basically has zero budget. So they're going to have about £1 million invested so that they can rent time on radio telescopes, and they're going to be using UK's Merlin Scope Array and the European Low Frequency Array. So it's pretty cool. A guy called Alan Penny from the University of St Andrews, who is part of this new network, which is going to be overseen by the UK SETI Research Network, said that even if we had just a fraction of the funds that the UK has, we could make an amazing difference. So there's a lot of optimism for, you know, a Brit finding an alien.
There is also a lot of pessimism in that SETI's been around for quite a long time now and has found precisely no evidence.
I do love that. It's like they've been doing this for decades and we haven't got an alien. What? There's a lot of
There have been some amazing events that have happened in the past that have suggested. Have you ever heard of the WOW signal?
No.
The WOW signal's amazing. So there's this... they were producing, I don't know what they're called, the graphs where it's sort of tracking radio frequencies and stuff. There was this really crazy burst of a radio emission from somewhere in the sky that whoever was manning the machine at the time sort of did an arrow next to it and wrote, wow.
Alien.
That could not be explained because it disappeared. They couldn't find it again. It was just this one freak occurrence that just happened and was recorded. If you Google WOW signal, it's fascinating.
You're listening to the wired.co.uk podcast. Got a comment? Drop us a line or several lines on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Well, we are going to move on to our last news story for today. A bit of a funny one. And we're calling this, under a new segment, WWWTF. WWWTF, that's what we'll call it now. You can probably guess what it stands for. It's weird stuff that's happening on the internet. And this week, ungoogleable band names, Liv.
Yeah.
This is a little fun story.
This is a fun story. It's a great guest post we had this week by Nimrod Kamer and Katie Crack. And they were saying that there's so much emphasis placed on making sure that your brand or your band is as Googleable as possible. You want to make sure that your company or your music is as easy as possible to find when people search in Google. And so that's why we see all sorts of awkward or abbreviated spellings of apps and then band names that are hard to confuse, such as Bat for Lashes and Rizzle Kicks. However, the authors describe an anti-trend for young bands keen to escape the imperialism of search engines and opt for completely non-exclusive names. So they've talked about bands like Pale, Citizens, Friends, Boats.
They all sound
cousins.
Like indie bands so far.
Yes.
I think so, that might be.
So if, for example, you search for Friends, you probably can guess that the first search results relate to the sitcom and not to the New York five-piece band. Now, other bands have tried to put things like spaces between every letter of their name, coasts and glitches. And this is something that Wikipedia won't allow. So it's a little, you know, F you to the man.
But why? I don't understand. Yeah. Why would you?
So that you never sell a record.
Well, I think it's a kind of anti, you know, not getting caught up in the hype of marketing or band. It is literally, you know, trying to stick it to the man. But then some have argued, and I think this is mentioned in the post, that it could be about having a challenge, about seeing whether your band or your company can get more Google juice than a generic term. Now, there's an interesting example of where this has happened. There's a band called Peace that has managed to out-Google every other search result for the word, including the Nobel Peace Prize and the Wikipedia entry.
So surely they're Google bombing some way.
Well, they've I don't know how they've done it, but they've managed it. They've been around for a while. And when asked whether he felt bad about ousting all of the other peace-related subjects from the top spot, the lead singer, Harrison Koisa, said he felt a little bit bad.
I just don't I mean, I get it, but I also don't get it. I don't understand why you would want to deliberately jeopardize.
Because then someone writes an article about it and they get more publicity.
I think it's a more interesting way. Yeah. But then, you know, lots of old bands obviously have lots of generic names. You've got Queen, The Police, The.
Got to be a big one.
Well, yes, that's what I was going to talk about. Like, because first of all, these bands mostly launched before the internet, or at least many of them did. And you could probably say the same about Wired, but obviously the brand launched 20 years ago in the US. But I wanted to think about what the least kind of Googleable names were. There's one that's just 3 exclamation marks, a band, which is just, the name is 3 exclamation marks.
There's a band called 3, just the number 3.
Yeah, that must Metal be a bit band. Annoying when you've got the mobile operator and all its marketing prowess.
Yeah, definitely annoying. Got to be a classic.
What about metal bands? I mean, it's quite rare. I mean, you say 3, it's quite rare that metal bands have these kind of generic names. They're normally slightly more notable.
Well, there are some amazing ones. I mean, they're not obscure names in terms of unfindable, but they're unique. I mean, there's a band called I Wrestled a Bear Once, but all one word.
That's brilliant.
You know, but a lot of metal bands, I mean, apart from the ones that are named after medieval torture devices, which weirdly enough came up in a podcast I was listening to just this morning.
Like what?
Well, Iron Maiden is an obvious one, you know, stuff like that. But there's some amazing, amazing band names out there. I mean, Flesh God Apocalypse.
Wow.
I mean, firstly, amazing band. Check them out. They're from Italy, kind of symphonic
Flesh
extreme death
God
metal. Fantastic.
Apocalypse.
Flesh God Apocalypse, yeah. You know, Chimp Spanner. Bit of play
I like
on.
That.
Yeah.
I like things with animals.
I love with metal. You can make anything up and it sounds a bit plausible, like Zombies Ate My Nose.
All right. Well, let us know if you were in a band. Would you want to be ungoogleable? And if so, why? Why? Honestly. Let's move to some feedback. We had some great feedback coming in at podcast@wired.co.uk recently. And we've got 3 outstanding pieces that we're going to select and put on display for you here today. The first comes from Ian Connerton, and this is a slightly truncated version of the email he wrote, because he wrote quite a lot. He said, I'm one of the Google Reader mourners. I've migrated to Feedly, which is not a bad replacement, and agree completely with the suggested improvements in your, he means mine, recent wired.co.uk post, though. This is following on from the story we talked about last week about Google Reader finally dying. But your discussions on whether Twitter, etc., allows you to digest content in a different way was really interesting, especially the idea of discovering new content by reading what others I respect are reading. Definitely got me thinking. He also asked us a question. He asked a couple, but the one I wanted to address was, what podcast management tools do you use in your shiny Samsung Galaxy S4? I don't know who he meant, because I don't have an S4, or do I?
You said you're almost going to change to it.
That's right. My work phone is an S4. I don't have a podcatcher on there, but on my iPhone and iPad, I use Downcast, which I think is brilliant, and it syncs across different iOS devices and things. I asked my brother, who's an Android user, works at CNET, so he tends to know other tech things that are good, and he recommends Pocket Cast for Android, and he uses that on an S4. Seen some good reviews for that. So thank you, Ian. Connor writes in from Ireland. Firstly, he says, the podcast is awesome. Thanks. Nate, you mentioned last time that you listen to a hell of a lot of podcasts. I do, 34 to be specific. I'd love to know what you guys listen to, and I'm sure other listeners would too. So some recommendations I think are in order. I listen to, I'm just going to pick some highlights out of here. Astronomy Cast, brilliant podcast for weekly astronomy news and education and things like that. Stuff You Should Know, Liv, you listen to that one as well?
I do, yeah.
We referred to this earlier, actually. This is the one that just did a episode on medieval torture devices, the history of, fascinating stuff. Tech News Today, which I'm a guest on occasionally, CNET UK. Answer Me This, fantastic one. Helen and Ollie, fellow tech people as well. Also, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a really good one if you're interested in fringe sciences and odd things that are going on in the world of science, astronomy, medicine, health. They debunk a lot of stuff and fear, uncertainty, and doubt that's out there in the scientific community. So that's a great one if you want to get your brain juices squelching. Also a big fan of Guy Cocker's new video games podcast. A couple of hours a week. It's quite a long listen, but gets a lot of developers on there, a lot of games journalists, a lot of insights if you're kind of really want to get head deep in the evolution of video games, and that's a corker.
Well, I'd like to add to that a couple that I really like. They're not necessarily always on Wired topics, but This American Life has some of the best told stories, in my opinion, and Radiolab as well, another US mega podcast. It's beautifully produced.
Also Naked Scientists. That's a corker. Liv, do you want to take the next email from Mark Ridley, who wrote in from France?
Mark wrote to comment on Feedly, but also to comment on the tablet app we talked about recently that coaxes cats into taking selfies using your tablet's camera. He said, following your recent talk about Snapcat, I went looking for it for my wife's iPad and our three cats, but it seems it isn't available for iPad at all, although there is an Android app out there which isn't compatible with my Nexus 7. So no selfies from our Moggies.
Yeah, I don't know if that was me misreporting which platforms this was on. I thought I'd said it was Android, but maybe I said it was iOS. But I wanted to give you a recommendation because I've downloaded a few apps aimed at animal fun. And
surely not.
Surprising. In place of this one, Mark, I would highly recommend iPad Game for Cats. It's not going to have them taking photos of themselves, but it's an iPad game that if you turn it on and put it in front of the cats, they are obsessed. They're sort of chasing this on-screen mouse, and it's a whole lot of fun for the cat and the owner. Okay, well, if you've got any emails for us, podcast@wired.co.uk, and we do encourage it. We love hearing from you. We wanted to point out that our Will I Am issue is getting some tremendous feedback from people at the moment, some great comments, and obviously we're biased, but it's nice to see our opinions backed up, particularly by people who maybe don't normally want to read about Will I Am,
yeah,
and are getting very pleasantly surprised, I think, about the feature that we've worked on him on. So that's on sale now. It's on tablet, it's on Kindle, it's on iPad, it's on basically anything you want to download it on. Go to wired.co.uk/magazine. All the links are there. And also, have you got any friends? If so, why not tell them about our podcast? Be meaning to highlight this more. If you like it, if you're listening, just tell someone. Introduce it to them. Tell them how to download it. What could possibly go wrong? Tell us, podcast@wired.co.uk, what could possibly go wrong? Anyway, that's going to do it for us this week. We'll see you again this time and next week.
Bye.
So long.
You finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.